What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. What are you looking for? Who's your perfect guy?
Well, first of all, he's too humble to know he's perfect.
That's me.
He's intelligent, supportive, funny.
Intelligent, supportive, funny. Me.
You know I'm married, right, Adam?
It's nothing a little Groundhog Day magic can't fix.
Groundhog Day magic and other means of putting your life in turnaround are the subject of this week's Film Spotting Top 5, Turning Over a New Leaf Movies. Plus, our review of Harmony Korine's Spring Breakers with James Franco.
All that and more.
I've got you, babe.
Ahead on Film Spotting.
Hey, I got you, babe.
Film Spotting is presented by Shutterstock.com. With over 700,000 high-quality video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level.
For 30% off your new account, go to Shutterstock.com and use offer code FILM3. That's Shutterstock.com and offer code FILM3.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Josh. We'll celebrate the onset of spring. It's coming, right, Josh? Any minute we'll have spring here in Chicago.
So I hear.
With our top five Turning Over a New Leaf movies a bit later in the show.
But first, I've managed to scrounge together $20 for tickets. My cousin's going to let us borrow his El Camino. Let's ditch class and go see Spring Breakers.
Come on in, sunshine.
Wakey, wakey.
Shine, little bitch.
Where's the money?
Money.
For what?
You know what?
All I know is I'm not going to sit here another day.
Spring break.
How are we going to get enough money?
I don't know. We're the only ones still here.
Spring break.
I'm tired of seeing the same thing.
Spring break.
It's your chance to see something different.
Spring break.
Just get that cash.
Pretend like it's a video game.
We can do this.
Spring break.
Twisted bangers in the club. I'm young. I got the young. Down a hatch of body pop.
What a magic place, y'all! You can change who you are, y'all. Bikinis and big booties, y'all. That's what life is about.
40 years from now, when James Franco is getting his Lifetime Achievement Award from the Academy, the career video retrospective better start with the monologue that occurs halfway through Harmony Korine's new movie about four college girls who escape to Florida for a week of drugs, drinking, and debauchery. The not-so-precocious quartet, including former Disney princesses Selena Gomez and Vanessa Hudgens, end up spending a little time in jail, only to be bailed out by Franco's hustler-slash-rapper, Alien. Yes, you heard that right. His name is Alien.
Some people call him Al, though, right?
That's true. My, what big gold teeth you have, I was waiting for one of the girls to say to Franco as he flashed his goofy, chilling Cheshire Cat grin. Anyway, back to the monologue. And for parents who may be listening right now via podcast with their kids in the room, I'll give you the obligatory earmuffs warning. Franco's standing shirtless on his bed that's covered in cash and guns, and he beseeches two of the girls, "Look at my shit. Look at my shit." And there were two more lines in particular, Josh, that caught my ear during Alien's oration. He says, "This is the American dream. This is my dream, y'all." He also says, "I got Scarface on repeat. Scarface on repeat. Constant, y'all." Tony Montana, of course, has long been an icon of hip-hop culture, so it's no surprise for Alien to name-check the Brian De Palma movie there. But I've always found some irony in the idolization of Scarface, since the story is about his rise from nothing to fortune and power, followed swiftly by self-destructive egomania and paranoia, culminating in his bloody downfall and demise. It's not unlike stockbrokers quoting Wall Street and worshiping Gordon Gekko. It makes absolute sense. And absolutely no sense at all. Josh, do you think that Korine, the provocateur par excellence, best known for writing The Disturbing Kids and directing films such as Julian, Donkey Boy, Gummo, and Trash Humpers, has provided something of a schizophrenic cautionary tale here? A movie with its thumping soundtrack and slow-motion close-ups of co-eds bouncing in bikinis against a vivid, almost entrancing backdrop of sky, sand, and sea that is likely to be venerated by the very people it arguably is admonishing. And what of all those comments multiple characters offer about the American dream? You're the guy, after all, who a few months back couldn't get behind the Brad Pitt movie Killing Them Softly, another stylish and potentially vacuous crime movie, because it's similarly strained to be profound. You wanted more subtlety from Softly. And there's nothing remotely subtle about Spring Breakers. Gomez's character is the lone innocent in the movie. She's the lone church-going girl in the group. And her name is what again?
Well, I think it's Faith.
Faith.
Pretty
exactly.
creative choice there.
So,
huh?
With all that said, do Spring Breakers work anyway?
So you're asking me, will Spring Breakers be putting this on repeat before they take their trip down to Florida in the future, 20 years from now?
I am curious what you think about that, yes.
And then sitting in the hotel room in Florida and watching Spring Breakers.
Yes.
That's probably how it would
Sounds
go,
about
right?
Right.
Yeah, I can totally see that happening. One reason I think it's very likely is because I actually found this movie to play it straight down the middle. It's completely obvious in the American Dream stuff, of course. And the other refrain we hear from Franco, spring break forever, mm-hmm. right? I mean, that's just beaten into our head. So it's obvious in that sense. But I didn't find this movie to either celebrate the debauchery necessarily, though a viewer could take it that mm-hmm. way. It certainly did not condemn what was going on in any way. And I've got to say, normally I would admire that in a film. Usually movies that allow the audience to do the work are the ones that I like. They mm-hmm. respect the audience enough. I don't know if this movie respects its audience, but when a film does allow us to be part of the interpretive process, I like that. We've talked about a couple films like that
For
recently
sure.
from Christian Mungiu. Beyond the Hills would fall into that category. I think Abbas Kiarostami's Like Someone in Love is also a film like that. But here's the distinction between those, among many things, as I was processing this. Those films feel like gifts to the audience in a lot of ways, where the filmmaker is offering something that we will be rewarded by wrestling with.
Mm-hmm.
I may be rewarded in a different way than you may be rewarded, but there's going to be something we're able to pull out of it. This didn't feel like a gift. It felt like a stink bomb.
Oh, no.
It felt like Corrine's just putting it here and saying, I'm just going to leave this, leave the room, and I'll let it stink
up
the place.
The maids can pick this up. Yeah,
yeah, somebody'll deal with it. Now, I don't know if that distinction makes any sense to you, but it was something that made this film, in the end, feel very light, very flimsy. Not a lot to dig into for me.
So you're not willing at this point to put Corrine up there in the same conversation with a Kiarostami or a Mungiu?
I know, I'm going out on a limb there.
You're mocking it. But
would you agree that it's the same sort of filmmaking in a sense that I don't think it's preaching down to us
no.
one way or the other?
I agree.
Okay.
And I also think that is a strength of the film, but I guess I like the film a lot more overall than you did. And I would go ahead and put him in that same conversation with Kiarostami and Mungiu in terms of what they're doing as far as challenging their audience. And I do like that schizophrenic aspect of the film. I like that it challenges you in that way where, as you said, every viewer can watch the party scenes and decide whether that looks like the best time ever to them or whether or not it's their personal vision of hell. I'm much more on the latter side watching most of the scenes from this film, but you know, I was never much of a party guy in college,
I
guess.
You didn't have spring break circled on your calendar in red?
No.
Looking forward to it from the first day of school?
Never made that trip down. But I am glad that you warned me, because even though you said you find the film kind of slight and flimsy overall, you did tell me, because you knew that I was going to be discussing it with you the same day I saw the film, and you said, hey, don't come straight from the movie
yeah.
to the studio, because you are going to have to wrestle with this one a little bit. And I have been all day long, and I actually wish I had more time. But to get to my question that I posed to you about the American Dream and that lack of subtlety there, or its aiming for some profundity, trying to have some kind of message, that didn't really bother me, because in those moments, I have to say, I believed every one of those characters when they said it. In this heightened Corrine world that we get, that actually felt a lot like a Terrence Malick film. Did you notice that at times with the voiceover and this lyrical style? It's often nonlinear. And
it's very nonlinear, yeah.
Yeah, it
we
is.
We don't know where we are no. often, and pieces that we've seen earlier come back. And
a lot of repetition
yep,
in
a lot
visual
of
moments,
repetition.
In dialogue as well. But one of the things that really stuck out for me with this movie that I really responded to is the way Corrine focuses on the way these kids seem to place an importance on spring break beyond just a week to get away from school and blow off some steam. This is an escape for them from their mundane lives. They see it as their ticket out to experience the world somehow, and they're constantly trying in order to heighten it. They're constantly trying to frame the experience they're having within a larger, more profound context. So you think about Faith. There's a scene with Selena Gomez where she's with two of the other girls and they're in a swimming pool. They've been there for a couple days. Looks like they've been having what to them is a pretty great time. And she's talking about how she wishes they could stay there forever. It's like this paradise, which also makes me think a little bit of Malick, of course. But she's getting really profound and trying to think about this experience within this larger context of her life and how it may be life-changing. And even the gangsta characters, we talked about Alien, and then he also has a rival character we meet. That whole notion of watching Scarface on repeat, constant, that does suggest that all of their actions, everything they take in, they're trying to place it within some sort of larger cultural symbolic context. So I think they're trying to almost be authentic or trying to have something that's real in an unreal world, because they can say, look at what I have. I have the American dream, because the American dream means having X, Y, and Z. I have those things. You don't. I'm better than you. So that's how they know they're a success. That's how they know they're somebody. And I think they're basing it all on these cultural signifiers of success. So I don't think they're trying to assign meaning to their lives in any way that's different than most of us. It's just a little bit more materialistic and a lot more hedonistic.
I think you're absolutely right in that this is an inflated experience they're seeking. It's not just to blow off some steam or to get away from the books for a while. One thing that was intriguing to me about the movie is how it becomes increasingly mythic, almost mythological in terms of how it's filmed and how the characters are transformed, especially after they meet Franco's gangster. That's when it seems to elevate into this larger story. The two characters I found most interesting are the ones played by Hudgens and Benson, Candy and Britt. Early on, I thought, boy, they're really not even allowing them to be individuals at all. The harsh lighting, frequently there's a red light used, so a room has the same tone to it, and they're both blonde. They're given the same sort of personality, many of the same lines. You can't even tell them apart. And I thought, this is really, you know, pretty disrespectful in a lot of ways. But they become almost the main characters, and they become these, at first they're sirens. They're figures of temptation for Faith, right?
Yeah.
To get her
Someone earlier in the film suggests they're almost demonic.
Demon blood, someone says. Be careful. Those two have demon blood, I think is what it is. Franco later describes them as mermaids. And it's important to keep in mind that in many mermaid tales, mermaids are these carnivorous creatures.
Wow.
They're figures of danger.
Are these the stories you read to your daughters at night of carnivorous mermaids?
Try to avoid those. But what happens, and one thing I did find intriguing, is how these two become the main figures. And I don't want to call it a version of girl power, though I think some people will want to interpret that way.
Possibly.
And that may be why this movie lives on with women viewers, too, because you could look at it that way. But that was interesting to me. So I did wrestle with this, and I struggled really hard to find something like that to hang on to that I could take away from and then say, okay, here's something that Corrine offered, this stink bomb that I took from it. Once I got through, you know, the stink, I found something there. But it felt flimsy to me, and I had a moment of clarity when I placed this movie within the real world, even as it became more mythical. And to bring this conversation way down, but it's the experience I had with it, is when I recalled the Steubenville, Ohio rape trial that was just about this week, I believe, this past week, where two high school football players were convicted of rape. It took place over a night of partying, and one of the most horrible aspects of this is the fact that other students observed some of this, or at least knew what was going on. Some of it was documented on social media, shared afterwards. And suddenly I thought, okay, this is a different case in a lot of ways. It's not a spring break story, but it's still a story of youthful sexual aggression.
Yeah, one partying through line, gone wrong. Just all
gone
limits
wrong.
Gone out the window.
And one through line to Spring Breakers, another thing that I thought was interesting was how the aggression, the anger of these teens or young adults was almost more alarming than the sexuality.
Yes,
me.
I agree.
So this echoes with what's going on in Steubenville. And what I thought is, boy, this movie, I want this movie to give me something, not to answer that, not to explain it, but something to help me process it. And it didn't. So in other words, what we're getting in Spring Breakers is a tame fantasy version of the stuff that happened in Steubenville. It's not helping me process it at all. And in the light of that real world incident, it looked awfully shallow.
I'm so tired of seeing the same things every single day. Everybody's miserable here because everybody sees the same things. They wake up in the same bed, same houses, same depressing streetlights, one gas station. The grass, it's not even green, it's brown. Everything is the same and everyone's just sad.
You're listening to Film Spotting. We're discussing the new film from Harmony Korine. It's called Spring Breakers. Josh, you thought it was shallow. I'm trying to give it more importance than that. I took away more than that. I think it's interesting that you use this term stink bomb because I get it in terms of the experience of watching it. And you are taking in a lot of things that are uncomfortable to see in moments. And you brought up Steubenville. There were some scenes where I actually thought Korine was going to go to a place I didn't want to go with
they back
some
away
male
from
characters
that.
And a female character.
That's very interesting that
who's
they
very
back
susceptible
away.
In that moment. I'm glad, I guess, he did. I just didn't want to watch it in that moment. But you're telling me just with the style of this film, let's just say on a very superficial, basic level, in terms of what he's doing with the camera, the vividness of the colors, the repetition, but by design, the repetition, and just the overall effect of this film where you almost feel like you're in a fever dream.
Yeah, that I wasn't appreciated
fun.
Some of that.
That wasn't
I appreciate
fun
it.
For you watching
well,
this
film? I don't know if fun is the
I
right
mean,
word,
I had
but
fun
I
watching it. I'd like to watch this again.
What I appreciated was the heist scene. That was...
It's great.
Beautifully done. Yeah. Early on, before they even leave for spring break.
They have to get some money. They rob a diner, basically.
They've got demon blood, so they decide, we're just going to rob this diner. And here's where the aggression comes out. We see that they bring a sledgehammer and squirt guns in there, and we think, okay, these are college girls. They're going to run in there, maybe chicken out.
How intimidating can they be, right?
They tear the place up.
And they're scary.
And that's where we see this anger. There's a lot of shots of them using their fingers as guns mm-hmm. to each other
Vanessa
in affectionate
Hudgens character.
Ways or to their own head.
It's those signifiers. It means something. It suggests
yes.
something. It suggests something of power to them.
And I think that's interesting. I guess what I'm saying is I'm getting that. In the real world, what is this movie that heightens it, that makes it a little sexier, even though I don't think it's endorsing it? I'm not saying that, but it is making it a little sexier. What is that giving me? That's why I say it's a stink bomb, because it's just leaving that odor behind.
Well, again, and you aren't suggesting he needed to answer it in some way, but he couldn't answer some of these things, or he couldn't provide a positive spin on it. I think it is the way the world is. But one of the things I think he does expose that I, again, go back to finding it so fascinating that you brought up the Steubenville connection. I didn't think about that at all, and I probably should have, because one of the things I really took away from this film that I did think was valuable was the way he exposed the leering, really scary male gaze and the way it's reflected in this film, how we see the male characters in this film observe, and that's a tame way to put it, the female characters in these spring break scenarios, because what became really clear watching this movie was just how much the sexual signifiers, these sexual actions, these motions that people do. You talked about the gun to the head. Well, there's a lot of physical actions that we see men do when they're interacting with women that are all about male dominance and subjugation of women. And I found that, as someone who has a daughter, and you have too, I found that the really scary part. I know that that exists already, but seeing it in these scenarios is something that I did find value in. I think that maybe people will watch this film, and I'm not saying they're going to walk out with some kind of big moral lesson or it's going to change their entire worldview, but maybe there's some value, Josh, in just being that much more aware of how scary that can be. There are a lot of scary scenarios in this film, and that is something that stuck out to me.
But we get that all the time. We get that everywhere. I mean,
Korine
isn't
seen
really,
it like this.
He's not really exposing anything. You can go back to 2003, the MTV Real World series did a feature film, The Real Cancun. That was the real thing, as the title implies. It was kids going to spring break. Now, that was
I'm
a film that
wasn't
I
as
found,
artfully made as Korean's
well, this
film.
Is what I'm going to say. That's a film that I found reprehensible, and I wouldn't apply that description to Spring Breakers at all. I think it's much more interesting. The Real Cancun is reprehensible because it puts these actual kids and lets them hang themselves, and we all watch. But these same things about the male gaze, we see this all the time. So what I'm hoping for from a movie that's going to make me deal with that again is at least give me something as well. I didn't get the as well here. Now, I want to also say, I don't want to put it in that category with The Real Cancun. I feel like you almost need to slam this film or love it. And I also want to talk about the things, including that heist and a lot of the visual style that was good. I thought Franco was great.
I do too.
Good.
I think he is.
Nice.
My name's Aileen. My real name's Al, but truth be told, I ain't from this planet, y'all.
Alien?
They call me.
Why are you here?
I saw y'all in there. You like nice people. Thought maybe I'll bail you out.
Why?
Why not? Come on, y'all. Why acting suspicious? Get in.
Where are we going?
Go wherever you all want.
Cotty.
Got the right idea? Come on. I'll be your chauffeur. Y'all can play Beyonce.
I thought for sure when I heard about this role and saw some of the clips, and this is a guy who does comedy. He likes to do comedy. I thought for sure we were going to get like a Saturday Night Live version of this character. He plays Alien as a real guy.
Yes,
and
he does.
It's more sad than scary.
Agreed.
Which is very interesting to me. I think it's a great performance.
I agree with you completely. In fact, I was going to go back to a movie we discussed recently. We talked about Franco in Oz, and we didn't really talk about him so much, but I bemoaned the performance of Mila Kunis, his co-star in that film, because what became incredibly clear to me watching that movie is she's one of those actresses who can be very good in roles that are very limited and very close to who she is. But she's not one of those people who can be theatrical. You can't put funny outfits on her or glasses or whatever and expect her to be a character. I would posit, Josh, and I wonder if you will go this far with me here, that James Franco is actually exactly the opposite. I would be totally content if Franco only played those kind of roles. It's uncanny how Franco is able to disappear into a character. And I think he's so much more interesting on screen to watch when he is one of these characters. Because you're right, there's something about this alien character that is so over the top and ridiculous that if you just watch the trailer or you see little snippets of it or even hear some of the lines from that monologue I mentioned, you want to maybe write off the performance as just way too kooky and comical. But it's not. There are moments that come through of, yes, actual humanity in his performance and actually some depth. And you're right, there is sadness there. And there's some moments later where we hear him talking about how he's actually scared of a situation. And we believe that because we see it in Franco. So he's someone who's just as much in some ways a product of his environment as these women are, as these girls are. So there is something more to his character that I was really surprised to see. But yeah, I think Franco can pull off these types of performances all day long.
So you're saying larger performances,
yes,
bigger performances,
yeah,
serve him better. That's interesting. I've got to think about that. I mean, I wouldn't say I actually like his work in the Spider-Man films, and those aren't large performances.
No.
I'm thinking about 127 Hours.
Which how I you think would, he's good in that film.
Yeah.
I
think he's good more often than great, maybe.
Yeah.
This probably is one of his best performances that I've seen.
I would agree. I do love as well, and I'm going to dance around this because I don't want to give it away for people that haven't seen it, but there's a decision Crean makes with the plot where, based on early in the film and how we meet Gomez's character, Faith, I think anybody watching the movie would say right now, I know exactly where this story is going and I know exactly what's going to happen to her character. And it doesn't go there at all. There are genuine surprises with her character. And there's a decision he makes with two of the characters. You mentioned that Britt and Candy, they become kind of the main characters by the end of the film. That's because Crean makes a really brilliant decision in the way he handles the other two girls. I love how I think it just reinforces the whole notion that this movie is exploring, which is this escape from reality that they go on, where they act out these fantasies, these cultural things they see on TV and say, well, now we're going to escape into this artificial world. It's great until it's not great anymore, until reality actually starts to seep in. And then all of a sudden they're like, you know what? Check, please. I'm out of here. And that's what he does with those characters in this film. They get out of there. And I think that's a great touch.
But what's interesting is as reality seeps in for those characters, it leaves the film. So that the
Which
second
was great
half
for me.
Is becoming further and further removed. It does, in a way, become more entertaining because we're leaving Earth. I mean, we're no longer, by the end of this film, we are in, and I don't mean this in a derogatory way in terms of style, but we are in a music video. We're watching people behave as people would in a music video. Things happen as
Not a lot
they would
of
in the
clear
logic.
Motivation, yes.
And so it just kept getting lighter and lighter, maybe more entertaining.
As
but
it
I
gets
don't,
darker and darker, though.
Not
That's
really
what's
because,
so interesting.
Not really because it became, the less it was rooted in reality, the less substance it had for me.
Hmm.
I still think a very interesting choice, which I would love to find out what the reasoning was behind it, is to leave that scene you talked about where the girl played by Kareen's wife, Rachel Crean, looks like she's going to be in real trouble,
mm-hmm,
because she's in a hotel room, from what we can see, with nothing but maybe five or six other guys.
Her friends aren't around, yeah,
not even is another woman around, and it looks like it's going really badly. That just kind of gets forgotten. mean, that's the best way to describe the resolution there. And that's one of those things, if you're going to make a movie about this, I feel like you got to go there too and make us eat that. I mean, you talked about how it made you uncomfortable. Exactly. Because that's the sort, that's where the movie is still a little bit attached to the real world. And it goes on and on and on away from that. More entertaining. I'll give you that. It's more entertaining, but flimsier.
Yeah, I don't know if that moment, though, I needed any resolution. Like I said, just from a comfort level, I didn't want to watch where that scene might go. But I don't think he has any responsibility to depict every moment in a spring break scenario like that as one that's going to end in some kind of sexual assault. I think there are moments like that 99% of the time that probably end just like the way we see him, where people are saying really inappropriate things. You think they're going down a certain path. They don't completely go there. So that lack of resolve there didn't completely bother me. It is interesting, though, that one of the things you singled out as a positive with the film is one of the few things that I had an issue with the movie, and that is those characters of Brit and Candy. I had to look their names up later because I had no recollection of what their names were, because yeah. I don't think they're ever spoken. They hardly themselves get anything to say. They really are kind of ciphers in some ways, or they're just instigators that help move the plot along, and we never really get any insight into them the way we do with Faith. And I'm not saying I needed a ton of insight, but there were times, Josh, where I definitely felt like it was a little too convenient for Crean. They're bad girls who get to keep his party going because they're more willing to venture into some dark places than the other girls, but they're nothing more than that.
Well, first of all, Faith is really a huge weakness of this film. I mean, the obviousness of the name itself, that's the amount of effort they put into that character.
Sure.
It's pretty pathetic, actually. The two that you're talking about, Candy and Brit, they're not people. That's why you responded that way. They're no longer people. This film ends with them as Victoria's Angels of Death. And,
right.
And they're coming out to middle America. They're leaving Florida. They're going to come after us. It's almost like a threat, where Kareen does seem to become a little bit more of the provocateur. But again, when the real world was in my mind, I just felt like my response was, so what? They're already in middle America. They're already here. You're not giving me any more to think about. He's a provocateur without much purpose in this film.
I guess I see a lot more purpose to it. Think about James Franco in the strip club when he's just throwing money in the air. It's another one of those visual acts that says to the world, I'm rich and powerful. I can literally throw money around. That happens throughout the film with these characters. And I love that that's a visual thing that reflects on the film as a whole in terms of what he's doing with the visual style. If you think about the beginning of this film, it's very interesting because it actually starts out as three different movies. It opens as almost an MTV-style Girls Gone Wild video, and then it goes to a college story of kids in their classroom, and then it goes to this little drama of these church-going girls, and they're shot in three completely different ways with completely different characters, and you're like, okay, what am I going to get out of this film? But that notion of how do you make sense of this when this imagery is just flying at you, these characters, I think that whole notion of these multiple perspectives just backs up what's going on throughout the entire film. And I do love, you're right, the heist scene where you see these characters do something from the distance of a car, and later you see them reenact it. And they're just saying it verbally, and that's more terrifying.
It's scarier.
Although we do
get flashbacks inside the diner in the reenactment,
but just
you're
their
right, because they're so aggressive, you almost forget that we get those flashbacks. You attribute it to their attitude because they're so terrifying.
That's it. Well, Spring Breakers is out now on about 600 screens. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us, feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail. We have a new number, 312-264-0744, or find us on Twitter @FilmSpotting and Facebook.com/FilmSpotting.
Things get physical next in Massacre Theater. I hope Adam knows how to take a punch.
We're in trouble.
Then we're going to find out the candidates for the next Sacred Cow film review in the Film Spotting poll. Stay with us.
Grew a beard and split some wood. Swinging. Pulling cars out of the ditch with my pickup and ball hitch. Bought a stove with a fake flame. The electric glow. I Christmas tree, but the squirrels made fun of me. What can I do to make it through the winter without you?
Hey folks, we want to interrupt here one more minute to recognize a regular sponsor on the show, but a fairly new sponsor to the show, and that is Shutterstock. Josh, this may actually be their last sponsorship of the show, their last week. So I'd love to keep them going. And one of the ways you can help keep them going as a sponsor of Film Spotting is to try out their service. We know there are so many listeners out there who would benefit from trying Shutterstock. There are many graphic designers and aspiring filmmakers and editors out there, just creative people in general, who need a site like Shutterstock that gives you video options and photograph options for your next creative project, whether that's an advertisement or a presentation or just for your website or blog. They've got clips in a variety of digital formats, most of them in HD, and they source video clips from around the world and put them at your fingertips. They actually add 10,000 new clips each week, so every time you visit, you'll find something new.
You can try Shutterstock today just by signing up for a free account. You don't need a credit card to do that. Just start an account and begin using Shutterstock to help imagine what your next project could be like. Once you decide to purchase, be sure to use offer code FILM3. That way, new accounts will receive 30% off any package. That's Shutterstock.com, and for 30% off new accounts, use offer code FILM3. We thank Shutterstock for their support of Film Spotting.
Winter candlelight service. Afterwards, we ate left side of this.
Hey, you got something for me?
Yeah, there was some guy here from Miles Jurgens looking for you. They need sparring partners for Apollo Creed.
Put me on.
Here's a car.
When was it here?
About an hour ago.
They're probably looking for sparring partners for Creed, you know?
I said that before, you dumb Dago!
You know, I've been coming in for 6 years, and 6 years you've been sticking it to me. I want to know how come.
You don't want to know.
Yeah, I want to know how come.
You want to know?
I want to know!
Okay, I'm going to tell you. Because you had the talent to become a good fighter. And instead of that, you became a leg breaker to some cheap second-rate loan shark.
It's a living?
It's a waste of life.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Josh Larson. I'm Adam Kempinar. That, of course, is Burgess Meredith has mixed some tough love from Mick with Rocky, played, of course, by Sylvester Stallone. And Rocky's going to come up as we get into our poll question as we look ahead to potential candidates for the next Film Spotting Sacred Cow discussion. It's basically exactly what it sounds like. We take a beloved film, a movie we haven't seen in a while, and that we want to revisit and see if basically it holds up.
Another way to measure it, since you mentioned Rocky, is films that if you say you don't like, people will get very, very angry
about
it.
And I wonder why you bring that up, Josh.
The more you dislike it, the more angry they get. That's a sacred cow.
That is a sacred cow, and that is very appropriate, as you did mention a few weeks ago here on the show, something totally heretical and completely misguided, which was that Rocky VI, which I actually think is a good movie, may actually be better than the original Rocky.
I said it is better.
Yeah,
that
you
may
did.
Actually be.
You're right. You said it was. So there are some stakes. There are some stakes to our discussion of Rocky if, in fact, we get to that. We'll find out as we get to our poll question. Right now, though, it's time for everybody's favorite part of the show, Massacre Theater.
We perform a scene, you get a chance at winning a prize. Last week, we massacred this scene.
Look at them bloody Catholics filling the bloody world up with bloody people they can't afford to bloody feed.
What are we, dear?
Protestant and fiercely proud of it.
Why do they have so many children?
Because every time they have sexual intercourse, they have to have a baby.
But it's the same with us, Harry.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, we've got two children, and we've had sexual intercourse twice.
That's not the point. We could have it any time we wanted.
Really?
Oh, yes. And what's more, because we don't believe in all that papist claptrap, we can take precautions.
What do you mean? Lock the door?
That was Graham Chapman as Harry Blackett. And if you wondered why Adam sounded like a man playing a woman, that's because he was. It was Eric Idle as Mrs. Blackett from 1983's Monty Python's The Meaning of Life. directed by Terry Jones and Terry Gilliam, written by Monty Python.
We heard from Chris Massa in Pittsburgh, PA. He says, Massacre Theater was, of course, from Monty Python's The Meaning of Life. The tie-in to the Religious Figures Top 5 was obvious, but it also, at least for me, fits in with the party theme for your Spring Breaker show. More than anything else, the regular fixture at parties that I went to as a student was endless viewings of Monty Python and the Holy Grail. I knew those guys in high school, Josh. I guess that says something about the kind of nerd I was and still am, but I have a hunch that I'm not alone in this, particularly in the film spotting community. I think he's right.
The sort of spring break parties you went to in college? You were talking about avoiding going to Florida. Did you go to these?
The Monty Python guys at my high school were the drama guys.
Okay.
The people were the tech people or sometimes the on-stage actors, but the big drama guys were always really into Monty Python.
We also heard from Sebastian Nebel in Trier, Germany. Monty Python's films are full of religious figures, foremost, of course, Graham Chapman's Brian, as mentioned in your top five. Chapman, along with the other Pythons, had a small cameo in 1960s religion-themed The Magic Christian, which also starred as a vampire, no less, Christopher Lee, of course. He, as we all surely remember, played none other than Satan himself in the 1975 comedy The Butcher, the Star, and the Orphan.
Sebastian working overtime.
Who else was in that? Why, of course, Michelle Simon, only 47 years after his turn in Carl Theodore Dreyer's The Passion of Joan of Arc, which topped both of your top five lists. Geez, put a little effort in next time, will you?
Shamed by Sebastian. Thank you for pointing out all the tie-ins that we, of course, thought about. We diagrammed them out ahead of time. So you weren't telling us anything new there, Sebastian. If you want to hear our rendition of that great scene starring Graham Chapman and Eric Idle and hear our top five religious figures along with our review of Christian Mungiu's Beyond the Hills, you can find that show at filmspotting.net or get it via iTunes. Josh, why don't you go ahead and reach into the Film Spotting hat? Good number of entries this week. Apparently there are a lot of drama nerds out there listening to Film Spotting, and tell us this week's winner.
The winner is Tiba Ford from Santa Cruz, California.
Congratulations, Tiba. Email feedback@filmspotting.net, and we'll set you up with your free 6-month subscription to Fandor.com.
What do I know? I'm lucky to get the part. I know that. I come from Chicago. We do things a little differently out there. We do the play as written. That doesn't go over in New York. Terrific.
We move on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater, presented by Fandor.com, a site to discover, explore, and share independent foreign and classic cinema. More information at Fandor.com/filmspotting.
Help support the show by signing up now. Film Spotting listeners get the first 30 days free.
I think this is going to be a tough one because we'll give you a hint. It's an older film. Most people listening should be familiar with it, but it may not be in a lot of listeners' wheelhouses. It also doesn't have a line in it that really gives it away, I don't think.
We're working around that line.
Yeah, we are working around that line that would make it the most entered ever, possibly, even if you'd never seen the movie. There's also a first here. I know we have done a couple editions of Massacre Theater that involved us having to do some sound effects. We've never actually had a prop before.
And it's a very expensive prop.
Oh, yeah.
We've blown the Film Spotting budget with this.
I love it. I can't wait to hear what you're going to do with this performance, Josh. This one, I don't know if you've got the right amount of angst for this.
No, I've never been this upset in my life, so this will be interesting.
I'm quite certain of that. I don't think anybody in the history of the world is upset as this character is.
Probably
there's another hint for you. You're going to start it off. I'm going to give you the action. Are you ready?
Yes.
And action.
Somebody ought to put poison in their Epsom salts.
Grandma.
Oh, get lost.
Hang loose, boy. I'm warning you.
Why don't you wash up and go home? Oh, this is cute.
Big, tough character. You don't kid me, pal. How come you're not wearing your boots?
Well, that's cute. That's cute.
It's too bad you didn't connect. You could have gone to juvenile hall. That's what you want, isn't it?
No.
Sure it is. You want to bug us till we have to lock you up. Why?
Leave me alone.
No.
I don't know why.
Go on. Don't give me that.
Please, lock me up. I'm going to hit somebody. I'm going to do something and I don't.
Try the desk.
And scene. Oh, I feel so much better.
I bet.
Decades of angst
just
have been unleashed.
All out of you now. It's out of your system. I love it. If you know what film we just massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Could have used a little bit more wine. Just a little bit more wine.
I didn't want to go too heavy on the wine.
Your deadline is Tuesday, April 2nd.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
May I have the password, please?
Fidelio.
That's right, sir. That is the password. for admittance. But may I ask, what is the password for the house?
The password for the house?
Yes?
I'm sorry, I seem to have forgotten it.
That's unfortunate. Because here, it doesn't matter whether you have forgotten it or if you never knew it. You will kindly remove your mask.
I'm not sure I like where this one's heading as we get to our poll results and you hear that scene from Stanley Kubrick's Eyes Wide Shut, Tom Cruise trying to enter the party. Josh, you of course remember the password, right?
The password? Oh, I forgot the password.
Well, you can't get in then. You have to sit out this entire scene.
That's okay.
Well, Film Spotting listeners, very familiar with Fidelio, and they want in the party here, apparently, as we were looking ahead to our discussion this week of Spring Breakers, and we asked you last week, which movie party would you most want to get an invite to? Your options were Animal House, Bachelor Party, Bridesmaids, Eyes Wide Shut, Old School, Revenge of the Nerds, or if you want to go to Vegas without me, that is totally cool. You know, basically, you're out. You're happy to stay at home and read a book. You don't need a night out like this. Josh, how did it come out?
Bachelor Party, Revenge of the Nerds, both at the bottom here. 4% for Bachelor Party, 5% for Revenge of the Nerds. Bridesmaids also only received 7%, not a lot of popularity. Here in the middle, we have Old School, which I would have voted for. We forgot to say where we would have gone.
We'll get to that.
I would have gone with Old School. 13%. If you want to go to Vegas without me, that's totally cool. You know, 15%. Toga, 22% for Animal House. And yes, the very disturbing winner, 34%, Eyes Wide Shut.
Well, as you said, we didn't get to our votes last week on the show, which is something we never do. Somehow we overlooked it, but every week we read the poll questions and we answer it, how we would answer it, how we would vote on the site. And maybe it was because I didn't want to reveal the fact that Eyes Wide Shut would have been
is
my
where
vote.
You would have gone?
Even though that whole thing is very scary, but the question again is, do you want an invite to? Yeah, I'm taking the invitation to that crazy party in Eyes Wide Shut.
Would you have accepted and gone, though? That's a whole nother level.
Well, yeah.
See, I think voters are talking tough here.
Well,
I think when it came time to actually go, they'd chicken out.
I was expecting you, after I said that, to just unleash on me all sorts of comments about how disturbing that was to know. And here we go. We hear from our listeners. Paco says Eyes Wide Shut is winning. At least we're an honest bunch. Zach says at least we are human with our Eyes Wide Shut votes. Bringing protection would be a must, as well as a colorful mask, of course.
Yes, don't forget that. Kathy wrote in, said, oh my God, Eyes Wide Shut is winning this poll. Who knew Film Spotting Nation had that hidden side? I guess you did, Adam and Josh, and I will look forward to your review of 50 Shades of Grey. Personally, I'd rather go to the Sandbar Party in Magic Mike.
That's a great choice.
I
think that probably is a better party. And actually, we're taking the 50 Shades of Grey show off. Our wives will be reviewing that one for us. I think that only is appropriate, right?
I haven't run that by Debbie
no?
yet.
No? Well, we have some
not
time.
Not sure that's going to fly.
I don't even think they're in production yet. We also heard from El Duderino. You may know where he's going to go. He says, the party at the Water Tower, first of all, Dazed and Confused. Great, great choice. But also Jackie Treehorn's Beach Party from The Big Lebowski. That's a good one.
Nice. Emily said, yeah, I'd want to go to the Moon Tower Party in Dazed and Confused. But if that's not an option, then the Toga Party in Animal House. Otis Day.
That's a good point. Cleo closes us out with the Christmas Party in Fanny and Alexander.
Tell me about the Christmas Party, Adam. Haven't
well,
seen
it's Ingmar Bergman. It's a great film. It's a masterpiece. I haven't seen it for a long time. I don't know that I'd want to spend that much time with that family. There's some disturbing things going on, as there always are in Bergman, but
yeah.
There's also a very romanticized notion of childhood that comes through
okay.
in that film. So that Christmas Party probably would be pretty safe. And I think it's a great choice, a very inspired choice there from Cleo. Thanks to everyone who voted and who shared their comments. That brings us to this week's poll question, and we touched on it with our clip from Rocky. We are going to have a Sacred Cow discussion next week on the show. It's going to be The Evil Dead.
That's locked
the
in.
The original Sam Raimi movie. We were looking at the new Evil Dead that's coming out, the remake of it, and we kind of thought, well, rather than review that, which frankly doesn't look that great, why don't we just go back and talk about that classic horror movie. It's been a long time since we've had a sacred cow. It's been at least a few months, and Evil Dead would be our first straight-up horror movie. I suppose you can call The Shining a horror movie as well, but it seemed like a good candidate. So that's our plan. We may also, in fact, though, spend a few minutes on the new Evil Dead.
Yeah, we might squeeze it in, right? Same night. Okay.
Yeah, so that's going to be a good show. Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune will be here for that. But with that in mind, we know we'd like to get to another sacred cow in the next month or so, and we've been trying to come up with other options, and after much discussion between us, Josh, and also our producer, Sam, and our associate producer, Candace, we came up with these six choices as the ones that we're probably most inclined to do a sacred cow discussion of. And the fact is, we may get to all six of these at some point down the road.
Right.
This is going to be an ongoing process, but you get to pick which one is going to follow Evil Dead. We're leaving it up to you guys. So what are their options?
2001, A Space Odyssey, if we want to go back to Kubrick. Edward Scissorhands. The Exorcist. Memento, Rocky, if you want to force me to watch Rocky again.
I do.
Trainspotting is the last choice.
So our namesake, Trainspotting, from Danny Boyle, and we do have a Danny Boyle film coming up in a few weeks here on the show, his new movie, Trance. We're definitely going to talk about that. So there are tie-ins all along the way here with some of these movies, as The Exorcist ties into William Friedkin and my talk that's coming up with him here at the Chicago Public Library in April, and Boyle there, and Edward Scissorhands following a lot of our Tim Burton discussion. Basically, for the sacred cows, there are movies for us that we haven't seen in a long time, and I'm not expecting necessarily to watch them again and discover I have a completely different take on them, but I know I could be surprised by them. Going back even to the first one we talked about on the show, our first ever sacred cow was Pulp Fiction.
Right.
I had not seen that movie in its entirety since I saw it in the theater in 1994, and I was very curious if it really was going to hold up as the great film I thought it was then, and it did. It actually exceeded my expectations.
And sometimes it's interesting just to see what resonates with you now that might not have done so in an earlier point in your life, or because the film seems to be touching on different things that are going on in the world now. So yeah, these are always fun to revisit.
I can't wait to see how this is going to come out. This is one where I don't really know how to handicap it. I don't know that there's a clear winner. I have a feeling listeners are going to go deep on us, and they're going to pick 2001, maybe hoping from some of them that we're going to be able to hopefully enlighten them in some way, or we'll really get into it and explain it.
No,
and that's not
going
to happen. I'm really almost begging our listeners not to pick 2001, even though it's a movie I badly need to revisit, and I've been on the record about that before. So I can't wait. Do you have a gut feeling right now how it may come out?
I could
Do you
see
have a
that
preference,
happening.
Josh?
I don't. I think all of these would be great to revisit. Mm-hmm. Honestly, I would like to look at Rocky again because I saw it so long ago, and then I saw it before Rocky Balboa. I revisited it again for that. So it's still been, what, 6 years, something like that. So I'd be open to that. Really, all of these are intriguing films. A few I do have fairly strong opinions about that I'm open to looking at again.
Okay. Well, you can vote now. You are going to determine the content on the show here as we move forward. You can vote at filmspotting.net. Last week, Josh, in this very same segment, I touched on the dearth of voicemails we had been receiving. I bemoan the fact that Film Spotting listeners weren't rising to the challenge and leaving us audio feedback, because being an audio show, we like to incorporate those from time to time. And somehow, we had not gotten a new voicemail since January 26th. And I basically was begging listeners last week to start leaving us more voicemails.
Sad.
And then, yeah, it was. It was very pathetic. And then I should have known. Over the weekend, I was thinking to myself, there's really no way we've gone since January 26th without a voicemail. The fact is, since we started that voicemail line, probably back in 2005 or at least 2006, we've never gone more than a week without getting at least one. So something may be going on here. Sure enough, I log into our voicemail system, and for whatever reason, they had stopped being delivered to our inboxes. They were still being stored online, but they weren't coming through our email.
Technical difficulties.
Technical difficulties, and I can't fix it. So here's the bad side. We've been getting voicemails, a whole slew of them, at least 20 or so in the month of March, that we had missed but still have access to. All the voicemails from the month of February have just been wiped out. We just missed them. We apologize to everyone who left us something great. I know there was probably the best voicemail
probably
ever.
Probably gold in there.
Gold that would give us content for who knows how many weeks, Josh. And we missed it, and we do apologize. But with that said, we had to go about setting up a new number using a new system that we know will work, and we no longer seem like a Seattle-based show. We don't have a 206 area code anymore. We have a 312 number here in Chicago.
They're going to find us now.
Yeah, exactly. So 312-264-0744. That's our new number if you do want to leave us some audio feedback. And over the past few weeks, we have gotten some good stuff, Josh, from people like Ethan, who asked us about movies from our childhood that we're actually afraid to revisit because they may not hold up. It's something we've talked about on the show over the years, but that's a great Ask Film Spotting question. I think we'll get to at some point. And listener Ben Howarth asked us about the trend, it seems, recently in films over the past couple of years, especially the past year, with films to have ambiguous endings, a lot of maybe forced ambiguous endings. So we've touched on that with a couple of reviews already just over the past month. Maybe that's something we can get to as well. So thank you to everyone who has been leaving us a voicemail and everyone who's written in with email feedback. We're going to get to some of that in this week's bonus content. A couple weeks ago, our top five was movie locations we wish we could visit. We're going to share your thoughts in the extra content this week, which you can get if you have the Film Spotting iPhone app or the Film Spotting Android app. All the information you need is available at filmspotting.net. Just click on apps.
No, you're not thinking. You're too busy being a smart aleck to be thinking. Now I want you to think and stop being a smart aleck. Can you try that for me?
Look, where's this going? What do you want me to do?
There's sometimes a buggy. How many drivers does a buggy have?
One.
So let's just say I'm driving this buggy, and if you fix your attitude, you can ride along with me.
The cowboy there with Justin Theroux's Adam Kesher and one of the looniest scenes from an absolutely loony but, for me, amazing film, David Lynch's Mulholland Drive. And we play that clip. It's fitting, Josh, as we're talking here about sacred cow discussions and listener input on the show. This is where that's really going to come through, as we're going to ask for your input when it comes to something that we talk about a lot here on the show without ever really getting into a lot of details about it, and that is the Film Spotting Pantheon, a set of films that we've put aside and said this is basically holy ground. These films cannot come up in top five lists. They're so good. We love them so much, and we have personal connections to them that if we did include them, if they were available, they'd come up week after week, and it would get really, really boring. Well, Mulholland Drive, believe it or not, not yet in the Film Spotting Pantheon, much to the surprise of many Film Spotting listeners who saw it in a list that I posted this week on Letterboxd. I've been using that site a lot. It's Letterboxd, boxd.com/filmspotting. I posted my list of movies that I considered the obvious Film Spotting Pantheon contenders, the next batch of movies that should be in the running. And Sam had a great idea with this spring show that we're doing. We're talking about renewal and rebirth. Why not look a little bit at the Pantheon and wonder whether or not we need to do some spring cleaning there? Maybe even remove a movie or two, but definitely look to add a movie or two. This is something we've never had a set kind of ritual for, and maybe every spring we need to do it, and we need to get our listeners involved.
We haven't talked about this in a year because it's taken me a year to understand what it is.
And I'm not sure
all
we
the rules,
still
all the
have
regulations.
You there yet.
We have penalty boxes to deal with. If you look at the Pantheon page on the website, we have an honorary Pantheon. So yeah, we got to do a little bit of cleaning up here, a little bit of narrowing down what this is, what it should be, and also how it should reflect the history of the show.
That's it.
I mean, that's one of the cool things about it when you do take a look at it is you see from Sam to Maddie and now with me, the films that have been beloved over time. And one of the things that really surprised me, the first show I was on, you grilled me, went through the Pantheon, didn't tell me you were going to do this.
This is bonus content. Yeah, I just sprung it on you.
Bonus content, you'll find it. And what did I think of all these films? And went through them all. And I liked them, the ones that were in the Pantheon. So it was too late. You know, you were locked on board.
In.
If I had disliked them all, you would have been in real trouble. And what's funny is week after week, I am shocked that we found this number of films to be on the same page about in the Pantheon. The more we disagree,
right.
I can't believe that these are films that we really do hold in high esteem together, along with Sam and Maddie.
Yeah, so that's the key.
I think that's a cool thing about it, and it also does lighten the load for the top five lists, because listeners don't want to hear the same titles. And that's why we're going to involve listeners too, because we have an idea of the ones we mention a lot.
You're tired of hearing us talk about.
But yeah, we want to know the ones you don't ever want to hear us bring up again.
That's really it. And I'm glad you touched on the history, because how this started was when Sam and I started the show, Sam now our producer, when we began the show back in 2005, we just came up with a mostly arbitrary list of these films that we love, but most of them you would consider classics. No one would really argue with them. They were the movies like The Godfather, Raging Bull, Chinatown, Citizen Kane was in there. We said, okay, these shouldn't be eligible for the top five because they're just too obvious. Over the years, Sam and I would add to them as movies came up more and more and listeners were getting tired of it. Then with Maddie, I don't know how many we added, but we definitely added some that were those films, again, that were coming up repeatedly. And with you, I think we've added two films since you joined the show about a year and a half ago. We definitely added Vertigo.
Yep.
And I believe we added Do the Right Thing.
I think that might have been on there. It was Grave of the Fireflies.
Really? No, yeah. I thought Grave was there and Do the Right Thing was the new one.
Oh, maybe.
Well, see, we don't have our history straight. But nevertheless,
this is why we got to clean things up.
It was a couple movies there. And when you did come in on that first show and we did the bonus content, I was a little bit worried because I want the Pantheon to reflect both hosts' tastes. And I was nervous that you were going to see the Pantheon and be like, what are you guys smoking?
Yeah, right.
Half of these movies are
what
terrible.
What am I getting into here?
And yeah, I don't want any part of this. And as we went through the list, you were on board with all of them, really. They're all movies you can say you at least like. Some of them you love. And do you want to actually, we've talked about this over email, do you want to actually just come clean about your overall reaction to the Pantheon as you look at it, as it reflects your taste? As it stands right now, there are 28 movies in the Pantheon. Are there any movies that do jump out to you as, okay, maybe if I was just picking on my own, they wouldn't be there?
I think they stand out a little bit because they're not necessarily in classic territory either, which I think is okay. You want it to be personal to a degree, but something like In America, which I did like quite a bit, I don't think that would show up on a ton of my top five lists. I'm not wild about it. Midnight Run does seem like a curious film to include. It's been a long time since I've seen it. Fond memories of it. But other than that, they really are films I would put up there as not only great films in history, but likely to show up on a lot of top five lists because, and this is what a great film is, it can echo in so many ways that it's going to apply to a lot of different subjects. So yeah, those are the only few that stood out to me as if we're going to take some out, make some room here, maybe they don't belong.
And these two were movies that came up for me as well. As I look at the Pantheon, there are really only three films that jump out as being kind of outliers in the sense that maybe they don't fall into that classic territory, as you said, and they are. In America, their Midnight Run, which Maddie and I added because we both love that film from our childhood.
Right.
It's a nostalgia film, but Sam also loves it. In fact, he may like it more than Maddie and I did, so it seemed like an obvious film spotting pick, even as it doesn't seem to fit with the rest of the movies. And then the other one would be Out of Sight. But you know what? Out of Sight's my favorite Soderbergh film, and it is a movie that all the previous hosts here on the show and myself have loved, so it fits for me. I think it's a classic.
It might be my favorite Soderbergh, too, and I think that is also one, especially as he talks about wrapping up his career, whether you believe it or not, that's only going to rise in esteem as well. Mm-hmm. So that's a potential classic down the road.
Yeah, and In America is one of those personal films. No, it's not a classic film. It may never be a classic film, but it's a movie that me and Sam and Maddie, too, to a lesser extent, we loved, and it kept coming up over and over again, and it just kind of made sense to put away in the Pantheon. So those are the two movies, In America and Midnight Run. I guess we'll have some further discussions on maybe they could actually come out of the Pantheon. We've never talked about a process for removing them. I do have to say about Midnight Run, when I posted the Pantheon on Letterboxd, it's also on our website, of course, under Top Fives, we got one comment from a listener who identifies him or herself as Collie Kibber that said, I forgot Midnight Run was on the list. That's like Lebowski's rug. It gives the place character. So there
you go.
That's
one way to look at it.
That was one of the reasons I liked putting Midnight Run in the Pantheon is it doesn't really seem to fit. And maybe that's why it should be there. So anyway, that's the current Pantheon. This brings us to the fun part here where we're going to put at least two films, maybe three, in the Pantheon. It's time to anoint some new movies. I do think we should do this every spring about this time. And listeners, you're going to have a major say in this. So you've come up with a list, Josh, of movies that you think would be eligible, that it's probably time to put them away. I came up with a list myself. As I mentioned, it's on Letterboxd, and I've got 14 or 15 here that I think qualify. And as I say them, listeners are going to be nodding their heads going, yep, they talk about that all the time. Yep, they talk about that all the time.
You can't have them all go in there either.
No,
right
no.
Away, so.
Or they'll be thinking, wait, that wasn't in the Pantheon? That's the reaction we're going to get here. So let's start with you. What are the movies for you that you think it's maybe time to put away?
Well, I'm going to have a few here that are in my penalty box currently, but I also think you like a lot, too, because that's how it's going to have to go. One of them would be Back to the Future. As much as it would hurt me not to be able to talk about that, again, I've probably talked about it too much already. Another one would be In the Mood for Love and His Girl Friday. I don't know if you've had it on a list, actually, but between me and Michael Phillips, I think we're pretty much done with that
one. Yeah, I think that's hard to believe that I've never put it on a list because I love it so much, but it's possible.
Okay.
Okay.
The Seventh Seal, when I did do a search on the website, it looked like that was on more of Maddie's list than yours, actually, but I know you're a huge Bergman freak.
I am, and I love that film.
So that might be one as well. So those were my four I thought had a pretty good shot at it. A couple others here. Metropolis, I've used too much. Alhazar Baltazar, I don't think you're as strong on that one as me. So that might be a just the stay Brisson away from film. It, Josh, for a while. The Brisson yeah. film.
Yeah, that is one for me that I didn't have quite the same love for, even though I greatly respect it. I greatly respect every film we talked about in that marathon. So I knew that was going to come up for you. That's a penalty box film currently, one yep. that's sort of off your list for a little while. So I think it belongs in consideration. The 14 or 15 movies I came up with here, and I'm just going to list the titles here real quick because I do have five or six that I think are the real contenders. But here are my movies that certainly listeners have gotten used to me extolling the virtues of over the 8 years of doing the show. All That Jazz, the Bob Fosse film from 79. Almost Famous, Apocalypse Now. The double pick, I don't call this a cheat, you have to put them together, Before Sunrise and Before Sunset, the Linklater movies. Blade Runner, Double Indemnity, one of the movies that made your list, Josh, In the Mood for Love. Lynch's Mulholland Drive, Tarantino's Pulp Fiction, don't know how that's not in the pantheon, I'll say it. The Red Shoes from Powell Pressburger, Tarantino's Reservoir Dogs, Howard Hawks, Rio Bravo, Tarkovsky's Solaris just came up for me in places I'd like to visit. And then my Bergman pick, one that has come up more often for me than The Seventh Seal, is Wild Strawberries. So those were my 15 movies that I think should be in the running for the Pantheon. I then took those and narrowed them down to the top six. And those would be, in descending order here, 6-1, Before Sunrise and Before Sunset, Double Indemnity, Pulp Fiction, Apocalypse Now, In the Mood for Love, and my number one choice would be Mulholland Drive. So as we then look at this, we didn't come up with a real plan here. We were going to kind of do this on air and then see how listeners weighed in. As we look at the ones you threw out and the ones I threw out, I think we need to agree on maybe six choices that we should put in a poll question and listeners get to vote on. And the top two or three vote getters are going to go into the Pantheon. So you are determining the Pantheon here, folks. What new movies are going to go in? We just have to agree on the candidates.
Are you okay with giving up this much power?
I am.
You're going to be able to do this?
I love it when listeners take pressure off me, actually.
But
so
for
let's
the Pantheon.
Do it. I know.
Pantheon.
No, I trust their judgment. I really do.
So it looks like In the Mood for Love is going to have to be one of them, right?
That's a lock.
Yeah. I was jotting down, as you talked, it seemed like Pulp Fiction.
Should be a lock.
Obvious.
Should be in there.
Yep. The Red Shoes, I would agree with completely. I don't know. I think I may have had that on one list since I've been on.
Not in my final six, but
okay.
I can see it. Yeah.
Mulholland Drive. You are a huge Lynch fan. I more respect and am curious about what he does, but I would probably put that on list. So
okay.
I could see that going in. What else do we have here? Almost Famous makes sense
Apocalypse
to me.
Apocalypse Now.
Apocalypse Now has to, yeah.
I know you're a big fan of it. Didn't you put it in your top 10 on the Sight and Sound list?
It was in
close?
My top 20.
Okay.
Yep.
So it made my top 10, Sight and Sound all time. It made your 11 through 20. That seems like a prime candidate. So right now we agree on those four. Mulholland Drive, In the Mood for Love, Apocalypse Now, and Pulp Fiction. As I look over your list, In the Mood for Love, we've covered.
Mm-hmm.
Back to the Future for me is one I think we should consider putting in the Pantheon. We don't have a ton of comedies in there. I adore that film. I think listeners would be on board with that one as well. And then I would go between Seventh Seal, Balthazar, Metropolis, and His Girl Friday. I think His Girl Friday is the obvious pick for the one that has come up the most on the show and needs to be retired. And it's a brilliant
film. It's a classic,
film.
Too. I mean, it fits that classic category.
Yeah,
so
those are our six films. We're going to put those six films in a poll question on the main page of filmspotting.net. We're going to accept at least two of them, maybe three, and your votes are going to determine which movies go into the Pantheon. So hopefully that was a little bit fun hearing about how this process works. As we said, we're going to try to do this every year. So a year from now, we'll not only consider some of these candidates again, but we'll probably have some new ones that have
depending
come in.
On what comes up in top five.
As they come in and we get emails from you telling us how you talk about that movie incessantly, please stop doing it. We'll know that those are movies that we need to put in Pantheon consideration. So again, vote now at filmspotting.net and help us determine how the Pantheon should look.
Spring is in the air. Well, it's not really, at least not here in frigid Chicago. Nevertheless, we're going to celebrate fresh starts and rebirths with our list of the best turning over a new leaf movies. The Film Spotting Top 5 is next. Stay with us.
Spring is finally coming on. The geese are pairing off. Here and there a snow squall, but the snow is almost gone. Hear the birds are singing and the days are getting long. Kentucky bluegrass growing green and girls in mini skirts.
Spring is finally coming on. The geese are pairing off. I guess I like you well enough. Perhaps we'll get it on. What a wind fidelity and the vernal equinox. Come on, girl, girl, come with me. Bring skin and golden locks.
We got to jump in here for a moment, Josh, not only to recognize our very generous donors this week and get to our thank yous, but to acknowledge the music in this show about spring and keeping with our theme. That's Kid Dakota, and the song you're hearing is Pairing Off from the 2001 album So Pretty. You have to love any song that manages to work in the phrase vernal equinox. How else could you incorporate that into Film Spotting but for a show that is about spring? So perfect. That was a perfect tie-in, a great choice by our producer, Sam. Earlier, you heard The Winter Without You, so keeping with the season theme there. That was from his 2011 album, Listen to the Crows as They Take Flight. Kid Dakota is actually Darren Jackson, a brand new performer to me. Unfortunately, it doesn't seem like I'm going to get many more opportunities to hear from Kid Dakota or see him live. According to Sam, in 2011, he returned to his hometown of Bison, South Dakota to become a music teacher.
That's a man of many talents.
Occasionally, he goes back to the Twin Cities to perform, though, and if I'm ever in that area, I'd like to check him out because I'm a fan of both of the songs we played this week. Hopefully, our listeners are as well. Let's go ahead and get then to our new donors for this week. We want to recognize Lisa in Huntington Beach, California, a gold-level donor.
Hi, guys. I love the show, and as a born and bred Ohioan now living on the left coast, it's great to hear intelligent film talk from my Midwestern peeps.
Thank you, Lisa. We also got another gold-level donation from Matt in Bellingham, Washington.
I think I must be at the top of the Film Spotting Moochers pantheon, as I've been listening since episode one of Cinecast and only occasionally tossed in a few cents or a copy of Emmett Otter's Christmas special for Adam.
I still have it. Thank you, Matt. Can't wait to watch it with my kids. We haven't done it yet, but this Christmas it's going to happen.
It's
I love that
happen.
Movie.
All right. But I have to tell you, the mental image of Adam jumping into a river of chocolate in Willy Wonka's factory in the last
episode
pushed me over the edge. Yes, I was mildly disturbed by the image in my mind, but snorted out loud to the confusion of those near me who did not have access to my headphones. Thanks for the many, many weeks of great listening and good conversation. You guys have consistently provided a spark to my week and an opening to some great movies. Your pal, Matt.
Certainly recognize Matt's name over the years, and other listeners in Bellingham, Washington. I do as well recognize Andrew Hall, another longtime listener from Voorhees, New Jersey.
I finally broke down and became a $5 a month subscriber. I've been listening to you since the early days when it was Cinecast. I never updated the bookmark in my browser. The redirect still works. First heard Sam and Adam discussing Ridley Scott's Kingdom of Heaven. I've frequently disagreed with you about many of the movies you review, but have never failed to be entertained by the podcast. Or should I say podcast, since I also follow SVU.
Andrew goes on to say, I'm hoping that Josh can hang with Adam at least as long as Sam did, because he provides a great counterpoint in your discussions. Also, his voice acting and masquer theater is superb. I look forward to hearing from Adam, Josh, Allison, and Matt for a long time to come.
You're too kind, Andrew.
Yeah, so that's great.
How long did Sam hang with
you? I was just going to say, I don't know if I want to give it to you because you'll start to see it as a deadline. And once you hit it, you get a week past and you're like, okay, I'm done. I can drop the mic now and move on. Literally drop the mic. You know, Sam, it's funny because, of course, he was the original, he was the original Darren. So people think about his time with great reverence, as they should, and maybe they think he was here longer than he was. We did a lot of shows together. There was a time, Josh, where we did two shows a week.
Wow.
And it was a little bit different. We're basically doing two shows a week at the rate we're going. The show is longer than it used to be. Not that I'm complaining. But Sam was only actually on the show from March 2005 to around August 2007. So just over 2 years, 2.5 years. So you still got another year of service to put in.
Sentence.
Yeah. You got another year at least on your sentence before you get paroled.
I can do that.
We also have a new Buck a Show donor who left us a voicemail recently. I hope we'll get a chance to play it on an upcoming show. Keith Geiger. He's in Ocean City, Maryland. Finally, two other donors we want to thank this week, and they are from foreign locales from far away. We love hearing from them.
That would be Bill from Cork, County Cork, Ireland, and Hari from Melbourne, Australia.
All right. Thanks to Bill, Hari, and everyone who donated this week. You guys are the lifeblood of our show. The monthly donors, whether it's $2 a month, $5, or $10, you really are keeping us doing what we're doing. We say it every week, but it really is true. We appreciate every cent we get and every positive comment we get about the show. Finally, have to mention the Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith. great interviews with screenwriters. Find that in iTunes. Just do a search for the Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith. And MoviePass, I just used it today when I went to see Spring Breakers. Work like a charm. Love seeing movies for free, essentially. Monthly subscription. You pay a flat monthly rate. You see unlimited movies in theaters nationwide. All you got to do is go to moviepass.com/filmspotting. And if you use the offer code filmspotting, you get $10 off your first month.
I used MoviePass to see Spring Breakers as well. Smooth as usual. Who had the more embarrassing theater experience, though? I went to see it Friday afternoon. It was me and about four or five other men in their 30s and 40s.
Yikes.
Was that your experience?
I saw it on a Sunday morning.
Yeah.
There were three other people in the theater.
Okay.
It was beautiful. No one was around me at all. They were in the back. There was one man, a little bit older than me, and two women, actually.
Interesting.
Who I heard chuckle a couple times.
Okay. All right.
So that was it. It was great. I love movies where there's only four people total. That works.
Spring is finally coming, we are young and so carefree.
Hello there, listeners over at the Film Spotting Mothership. This is Allison Wilmore from the Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit podcast. On our latest episode, we talk time travel movies available on streaming and VOD sites like Netflix, Hulu, and more.
In our Listener's Choice review, we attempt to untangle Shane Carruth's minimalist sci-fi Sundance favorite, Primer. Will we succeed? Or did we succeed? Or will we succeed again? Almost certainly not, but you can listen to us flounder or subscribe to the podcast at iTunes or at filmspottingsvu.com.
Hey, this is Mark Duplass, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
Are you in some kind of witness protection plan?
Sam...
Some kind of what? This is no laughing matter, Edie.
Of course he's not, Sam.
I'd just like to hear Tom say that.
Okay. No, I'm not in a witness program. Those men just have the wrong guy. They must have seen me on TV, and I guess I reminded them of this Johnny guy.
Joey,
somebody. Good Lord. The idea of me...
I never honestly believed it, but I had to ask.
You're listening to Film Spotting, and you just heard Viggo Mortensen as Tom Stahl from A History of Violence, the David Cronenberg film from 2005. Certainly a character there in Tom Stahl who, as we come to learn throughout the movie, has gone through a bit of a rebirth, a character who has reinvented himself and started over in a new town. And that's why we thought it was a perfect transition into our top five this week, which connects to this overall theme this week from our discussion of Spring Breakers. Spring, renewal, time for a fresh start. And we looked at those movies that involved characters going through those types of transformations. Josh, how did you form your list?
I just tried to stay away from personal redemption stories.
Okay.
That was the only thing I wanted to do. And maybe some of these could still fall into that category. But the basic idea being that a character has to achieve some sort of redemption wasn't necessarily what I was looking for.
Okay.
We toss around some of the phrases you used as we were trying to work around this. Fresh starts, rebirths, went with the category of turning over a new leaf. All those sorts of ideas I tried to keep in mind.
Yeah, turning over a new leaf seems to work. Not only it fits with this idea of starting over, but it has a nice spring feel to it, doesn't it? Spring sound to it.
Exactly.
So with that, what's your number five?
Number five is It's a Wonderful Life, which is really more of a rebirth of priorities or a rebirth of perspective than any sort of physical change. And the title, of course, speaks to that. George Bailey must be reborn to this realization that he has led a wonderful life, not because he's achieved the things that he set out to achieve, but mostly because of what his generosity has made possible for others. A listener suggested places from Frank Capra movies for our recent list, top five movie locations I wish I could visit. And that led you to mention Bedford Falls. That's, of course, where George Bailey lives. Now, in Capra's 1946 movie, we get two Bedford Falls. We get the quaint, content town for the most part, thanks to George's sacrifices. And then we get this other vision, the pitiful one that would have existed had he not been around to be such a crucial influence. The joy of this movie, I think, of course, is that George decides not to take his own life, but that he comes to this truly countercultural understanding of what a good life can mean. And in this case, it's not the achievement of personal dreams, but of giving of yourself for others.
Obviously a classic film, and a great pick. I really struggled with this list because as I was going through all the different candidates and the different permutations of what we were calling it, I realized that there was so much crossover with not only redemption movies, but other film spotting top five lists over the years. We mentioned A History of Violence. A History of Violence made my top five movies about starting over. So I've done that before. We've also done movies about redemption. And a lot of addiction movies are movies about personal redemption and people trying a fresh start. So all three of those lists have been well covered here on the show. I didn't want to go down those paths. So the challenge I set for myself, Josh, with this list was I was going to pick five movies that fit completely with the turning over a new leaf idea and that I'm genuinely a big fan of. But the key thing for me was they had to be five films that have never made a film spotting top five before.
Uh-huh.
I'm going down new ground.
You're
here.
You're preparing for a new pantheon.
That may be it, in fact. So I'm forcing myself to turn over a new leaf as well and give some love to these movies. Speaking of the pantheon, we should note that there are at least three movies in there that probably count as turning over a new leaf movies that we won't be covering. Casablanca, maybe, at least a redemption film. The Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, certainly. And Jack Lemmon in Billy Wilder's The Apartment. So those three movies aren't going to be mentioned. But a movie that is going to be mentioned, and look, I'll be honest, it doesn't belong in the same category as those three movies I just said, but I am a big fan of it. It's In Her Shoes. It came
up,
yeah, it came up during a recent top five, Directors Who Need a Comeback. We threw out whether or not Curtis Hanson was a director who needed a comeback, very memorably did L.A. Confidential, and that made him a director that a lot of film spotting listeners, and myself included, were really into, and he hasn't done as much lately. But this is a movie that I didn't see in theaters, came out about 6 or 7 years ago. Caught up with it on cable. I remember that Sam, at the time, he reviewed it on the show and had a mixed reaction to it. And I made one of those ridiculous kind of guy assumptions that a movie about two sisters and their estranged grandmother wouldn't be my thing, and I just didn't care about it. And then I caught up with it one day, and I was grateful, Josh, that nobody else was in the room as I was stifling tears by the end of this movie.
No way.
Yes,
watching
Toni Collette and Cameron Diaz as the sister, Shirley MacLaine as their grandmother. Collette is a lawyer named Rose. She's the older sister who really seems to have her life all together, but she's dealing with romantic problems at work and just general self-loathing issues. And then her younger sister, Maggie, played by Diaz, is the wild thing who can't keep a steady job. She drinks too much. She's basically a train wreck. And an incident happens between them where Rose finally says, "Get out. I can't take it anymore. I don't want to ever see you again." And that's what forces them both to embark on new paths in their lives. And at that point, Diaz's character discovers that Ella, played by MacLaine, is down in Florida, is this grandmother who's still alive, and she's going to go down and meet her. So the new leaf comes in the form for Rose of deciding that she's going to leave her job as a lawyer, and she's going to become a dog walker. She's just going to get out of the rat race completely. And Maggie, with Ella's help, gets a job. She discovers she's actually good at a few things. She stops drinking and partying and just overall tries to grow up. But the whole film is about these characters making new discoveries, learning new information that changes their perception of their family, of each other, of the world. Maggie learns at one point that their mother probably took her own life. And learning that, she has to completely alter how she views her father, her dead mother, her sister, who always had a burden as the older sibling that she didn't have to bear.
It was on purpose, wasn't it? The car, the tree. Was it even raining that night? There was so little. How do you tell a six-year-old her mom left by choice? Who told you? No one.
As a former English major, I love the scene in this movie that's a pivotal scene involving Cameron Diaz where she has to read one of my favorite poems of all time, One Art by Elizabeth Bishop. That plays a key role. And the last scene of the film, I'll just say it. It's another one involving a poem. It's where I almost start to weep like Giovanni Ribisi at the end of Boiler Room. You know, where
it's
like
not pretty.
Where it's I'm heaving and like snot is flying everywhere. No, it's not pretty, but that is what happens to me. At the end of all movies of In Her Shoes, I'm going on the record. It's just a reality. I think it's a really good movie.
Hey, it certainly fits for this list. I'll give you that, but I'm much closer to Sam in terms of appreciation for it. My number four is What About Bob? Frank Oz's 1991 comedy about the patient of a psychiatrist who follows the psychiatrist on his family vacation. Bill Murray is the patient, of course. Richard Dreyfuss is the doctor. Now, the joke, the obvious joke, is that Murray is revealed to be more caring, really a more caring and healthy person than Dreyfuss's doctor, who's pompous and cold to his family. Bob does have a breakthrough on this vacation, and he does turn over a new leaf by the movie's end.
I sail! I'm a sailor! I sail!
Isn't this a breakthrough?
I mean, that I'm a sailor? I sail?
I sail now?
Keep sailing, Bob.
Out on a boat on the lake, way far away from the dock, the end of the wind with the sky and everything. Ahoy!
I don't know that that's exactly what the film is about, though. The question you're really forced to ask is who's really getting the fresh start here? Because Murray becomes better, yes, but Dreyfus has a sort of negative rebirth in this film, and the movie follows that through all the way to the end. He becomes a worse person, and he's worse off in the end. So that begs a second question. Is this a comedy, or is this a tragedy at one level? I think What About Bob lasts because it is one of those broad comedies that flirts with this other side. It certainly has a mean streak. You have to say that about it.
Another good pick. I'm wondering, Josh, as you were forming your list, if any directors in particular stood out, and I don't want to jump ahead as we may get to some of these, but just as we were talking last week about our top five religious figures, there was that handful of 5 to 7 filmmakers,
sure,
that were,
yeah,
obvious go-tos. Were there any directors who seemed to really deal with this territory repeatedly?
I didn't go director
because
first this time.
I didn't either, but I came up with two along the way as I was thinking about movies. One of them, I would argue, you could potentially put just about any Paul Thomas Anderson film in the mix of this rebirth, new leaf discussion, because a lot of his characters, so many of them are dealing with integrity issues and identity issues and are trying something new and trying to become a quote-unquote better man. We see it in Heart 8. We see it in different characters in Magnolia. You see it with Freddie Quell, certainly in The Master. You see it with Dirk Diggler, too, trying something new in that film at many points throughout Boogie Nights. So just about any PTA film, and a lot of them have made my top fives in the past, so I kind of ruled them out. But in addition to him, the other director that came up for me repeatedly was Cameron Crowe. And my number four pick is Jerry Maguire, the film starring Tom Cruise. And this point I'm going to bring up here serves almost no purpose, except it's a little bit of inside baseball. As we talk about doing what we do here every week, we talk about movies and write out our notes, or you write your written reviews. And I was looking on our website to see if I had ever talked about Jerry Maguire before, if it had ever made a top five. It never had. But I came across my written review that I wrote in 2001 of Almost Famous. And it was the first movie I ever reviewed, the first movie I reviewed, and it got published in a newspaper. And it was really interesting because I read a line in that review where I said, like Tom Cruise's sports agent with a conscience and Jerry Maguire, and Say Anything's Lloyd Dobler, William is somewhat of an outcast, the one person of character and integrity in a world full of phonies. And I obviously think that's true, and I think that line holds up. But what's so fascinating about it is that's something I had never thought about until I sat down to write the review. That's really what we do, why we do this show, right? And why you write reviews is because the second you force yourself to write about something and think critically about it, all of a sudden some kind of epiphany comes out. And I'm not saying that's jaw-dropping or groundbreaking, but I came to an understanding of the types of characters I'd seen in Cameron Crowe's films only because I forced myself to sit down and really think about that character, William Miller, and Almost Famous. So that line has always stuck out to me because that was the first epiphany I ever had writing a review, basically, and I've remembered it. But I am a big fan of Jerry Maguire as well, and he is that character who has an epiphany early in the film where he has a confrontation with the son of a hockey player, actually, and the kid says something to him that completely rocks his world and forces him to reevaluate everything.
I couldn't escape one simple thought. I hated myself. No, here's what it was. I hated my place in the world. I had so much to say and no one to listen. And then it happened. It was the oddest, most unexpected thing. I began writing what they call a mission statement. Not a memo, a mission statement. You know, a suggestion for the future of our company. A night like this doesn't come along very often. I seized it.
And he thinks everyone's actually going to hail him as a hero. And of course, we see they really think he's a laughingstock. And I'll be honest, I haven't watched Jerry Maguire since it came out. I know I say that a lot, but I don't get a chance to rewatch a lot of movies because there are so many movies I still feel like I need to see for the first time. And it's probably easy to look back at that film and hate on Jonathan Lipnicki, the precocious kid, or hate on Cuba Gooding Jr. and the Show Me the Money and those lines like that. But I thought Cuba Gooding Jr. was really fun in that role and has some real genuine moments beyond those big showpieces. I think Zellweger's good, Cruise is good, Bonnie Hunt is very good as Zellweger's sister. And my only real knock on the film has ever been that there's a big sports scene that's the big redemption scene for one of the characters, and it's very phony and just fake, and nothing about it really plays out the way it ever would in real life, which is a problem when you have a movie that's so about this world of pro sports.
And has so
and
many
football.
Genuine moments,
exactly.
too.
Exactly, yeah, and it does have so many, but that one really stands out for me. But I am a sucker for these what kind of man am I movies, what do I stand for, that's what this film very much is. And even though I rate it behind Almost Famous and Say Anything and even Singles in Cameron Crowe's filmography, I'm a big fan of it.
What's interesting about Jerry Maguire, just in terms of story construction, is it starts at what would otherwise be the climax for a lot
yeah,
of films.
It's during the opening credits,
yeah,
actually.
It follows the implications of turning over a new leaf.
That's
really,
it.
Really interesting.
And that
movie.
Was important to me. I didn't want to pick movies where it was only in the end they were finally redeemed.
Those are more redemption, yeah. Number three, I'm going to return to my choice for the best animated film of all time. That's Disney's Pinocchio from 1940. Of course, this is a film and a story that begins with a rebirth. You've got Pinocchio's transformation from an inanimate toy to a sentient toy. But then we have the movie's true rebirth, his quest to become a real live boy. One of the reasons this movie resonates so much with kids, I think, aside from the terrifying darkness we've discussed on the show before, is that this quest for rebirth can be seen as a metaphor for growing up, getting older, getting to go on to that next stage of life, which so many kids are eager to do before they're really ready. I mean, most kids want nothing more than to get bigger. For little kids, they see the next age bracket as this gateway to greater freedoms. They'll be able to do so much more, right? But for teenagers, it's also this idea of they see being older sometimes as a chance to get a fresh start, to turn over a new leaf, to establish an entirely different identity in college, something like that. So I do like this idea of different phases of life being rebirths of sort, and I think Pinocchio certainly plays with that.
Yeah.
I can talk. I can walk.
Yes, Pinocchio. I've given you life.
Why?
Because tonight, Geppetto wished for a real boy.
Am I a real boy?
No, Pinocchio. To make Geppetto's wish come true will be entirely up to you.
Up to me?
Prove yourself brave, truthful, and unselfish, and someday you will be a real boy.
A real boy!
You're listening to Film Spotting. We're sharing our top five turning over a new leaf movies, tying in with our theme of spring and renewal this week as we talked about the new Harmony Korine film Spring Breakers, which really has nothing to do with renewal, though it is a movie that deals with people trying to find a new path in their lives.
Some of them transform a little bit.
They do transform for better or for worse. My number three pick is a movie that I know is definitely beloved among Film Spotting listeners, and it's a movie I liked but didn't really have the reaction to it initially when I was 17 when I saw it that I did to other famous movies that starred this actor. The actor is Bill Murray. The film is the one we reference at the start of the show, Groundhog Day.
Yes.
And maybe it's just because I was such a fan of the ones from my childhood, Ghostbusters, Stripes, even Meatballs, the nostalgia stuff, that I didn't have that kind of over-the-moon reaction for Groundhog Day. But as I've seen more of it over the years, and I've watched it repeatedly, it's on TBS and different cable channels certain times of the year, of course, I really have discovered why this movie is so beloved. It should be. Bill Murray, it goes without saying, is so good in that title role as Phil Connor because he makes Phil unlikable, but he's still sympathetic because he's so damn funny and he doesn't care in a way that is actually a little bit charming. And he gives that character somewhere to go from the beginning of the film to the end. We want to see him change. We want to see him evolve. We want to see him become a better man. And that dinner montage scene with Andie MacDowell is so funny because you see him molding himself into her ideal man.
I think people place too much emphasis on their careers. Gosh, I wish we could all live in the mountains, at high altitudes. That's where I see myself in 5 years. How about you?
Oh, I agree. I just like to go with the flow.
Yeah?
See what happens.
Well, it's gotten you here.
Uh-huh. Of course, it's a million miles from where I started out in college.
Oh, yeah? You weren't in broadcasting or journalism, anything like that?
Believe it or not, I studied 19th century French poetry.
La fille qui j'aimerais sera comme bon vin. Que c'est bon fera un peu chaque matin.
You speak French.
Murray is just savoring those romantic French lines the way only Bill Murray can. And along the way, he tries to pass himself off as the perfect guy for her. But of course, he actually becomes the perfect guy for her. That is that transformation, that journey that he takes. So Groundhog Day is my number three.
Great pick. My honorable mention. How many Murray movies could I have on my list, though?
True.
I had to go with What About Bob instead. Now, I think a lot of superhero sagas probably could have qualified for this list, but the one that felt the most like a rebirth, and the filmmaker, you asked about filmmakers that maybe this fit. I think the filmmaker who best captured that aspect of the story was Christopher Nolan with Batman Begins.
Yeah.
His vision of Bruce Wayne is of a man who forces rebirth on himself, really. He has this thwarted attempt to kill his parents' murderer, and when that doesn't work, Wayne leaves Gotham, his desires to disappear into the criminal underworld, and that's where he eventually meets Ra's al Ghul, and he's formed into Batman.
Your parents' death was not your fault. It was your father's.
If this is a new leaf, it's a dark one.
Yeah.
Definitely a dark one. Because even as Batman begins to become the savior of Gotham, it's at great cost to him, great personal cost. And that's part of what makes this series such a grand tragedy. You could probably argue, maybe we'll run into it later on your list, that The Dark Knight Rises is the better choice for this list, especially in its final moments. But I think that offers a different sort of fresh start than the one I always appreciated about the Batman series from Nolan. It's a bit more of a traditional fresh start, and I always love this franchise the most when it's the darkest.
Well, I don't think it's so much the ending of The Dark Knight Rises, though there is that moment of transformation, but it's really turning over a new leaf at the start of that film as well. Remember that Batman at that point has been out of commission for eight years.
True.
So
That's
as soon as you brought up Batman Begins, I was like, wow, how did I not only overlook that film, but overlook The Dark Knight Rises? I'm not sure The Dark Knight, which I haven't seen in a while, qualifies as much, but those two certainly are good candidates for this list. And that does segue nicely, actually, into my number two, which is also a superhero movie, but an animated one, and one I thought for sure would make your list. It's Pixar's The Incredibles.
Mm.
You've got Bob Parr in that movie, the husband, turning over two new leaves. He goes from superhero, bachelor, then eventually dating Helen, to husband, father,
yes.
Responsible adult, pencil pusher. He's no longer anything spectacular. He just goes to work, and he comes home, and he does what, quote-unquote, normal people do.
I'm not happy, Bob. Not happy. Ask me why.
Okay. Why?
Why what? Be specific, Bob.
Why are you unhappy?
Your customers make me unhappy.
What? You've gotten complaints?
Complaints I can handle. What I can't handle is your customers' inexplicable knowledge of InsuraCare's inner workings. They're experts! Experts, Bob! Exploiting every loophole, dodging every obstacle! They're penetrating the bureaucracy!
Did I do something illegal?
No.
Are you saying we shouldn't help our customers?
The law requires that I answer no.
We're supposed to help people.
We're supposed to help our people! Starting with our stockholders, Bob! Who's helping them out, huh?
And like a lot of normal people, he's miserable in that job he has and dealing with his boss. And we see him struggle with that and doing some superhero stuff covertly. And then he gets a chance finally to reject that and finally embrace who he really is and learn along the way that he can still do that and be a family man. This is a movie that, another one actually, that I really liked the first time I saw it, but didn't put it up there with Pixar's best stuff. And then I rewatched it with my kids probably just 3 or 4 months ago, and discovered that I really needed to give it more love because it's a fantastic film. And of course, Brad Bird's a wonderful filmmaker. I love The Iron Giant. I love many aspects of Ratatouille, but this is just not only a fun film and an entertaining superhero movie, but it's got that heart you expect from a Pixar movie. And that first time I saw it, I only had one kid. And I don't know, maybe over the years, it just hits me harder now. But seeing that transformation that Bob goes on and seeing him embrace his role with his family more, that does hit me a lot harder now as I see it. I don't get weepy like I do with In Her Shoes or anything.
Wow.
But I do really connect with it.
Yeah, I think what part of that might be is The Incredibles hits you so hard as a spectacular action film immediately. So it's easy to just take it that way before you realize what a rich story it is as well. I don't have a Pixar film on my list, but my number one is an animated film. It's My Neighbor Totoro. It's my number one because it's so tied to the natural world, which just felt right. It nicely reflects the spring theme that inspired this list. It's Hayao Miyazaki's 1988 feature, and it follows a professor who moves with his two young daughters to an old house near this forest. They do this so that they can be closer to the hospital where their ailing mother is staying. You get the sense it's a very serious illness she has. The girls end up befriending a number of forest spirits, including this giant obese rabbit creature thing called Totoro. And the one that was the biggest hit in my house with my kids, the cat bus.
Yeah,
I thought that was
pretty
cool. Now, this is clearly a tale of rebirth, or rather regrowth in a lot of ways. And the natural elements do come to mirror the family's return to health. It may seem to be a bit obvious in that degree. At one point, the girls are given a bunch of seeds by Totoro. They plant them, and they magically grow quickly into this enormous tree. So maybe that seems a little hokey if you haven't seen it, but it's actually completely organic how this happens as a narrative. The story doesn't unfold or progress along plot points. It seems to just grow, and it develops all sorts of these odd little offshoots. We get these beautiful, strange flowers popping up. It's a wonderful, wonderful film.
It is.
I think Miyazaki is maybe one of those filmmakers. I'm answering your question as I think about it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe one who could qualify for a lot of turning over a new leaf films.
No doubt.
I think Totoro felt like the most natural fit.
Huh. Yeah. I now want to go back through his filmography and kind of redo my list and wonder if some of those other films, because I think there are probably elements of it in Spirited Away and,
sure,
and many others. But Totoro is a wonderful film and a great pick for your number one. My number one, turning over a new leaf movie. I'm getting a shot at redemption here, Josh, after last week. We haven't heard any feedback yet from listeners, but our producer did scold us for our bad French pronunciation of Laurent.
Now, why do you have to bring that
Laurent
up?
It needs to have the D in it.
We did enough pronunciation scolding without doing it ourselves.
Shot at redemption this week, I'm going to pick a Belgian film that compels me to speak some French. It is L'Enfant.
I think you got that wrong.
Or, I probably did, The Child. Let's call it The Child, okay, from the Dardenne brothers, the directors of one of your favorite films and mine from last year. We were big fans of The Kid with a Bike. This is their movie from 2005 that was the Palme d'Or winner at the Cannes Film Festival. It stars Jeremy Renier. He plays a 20-year-old character who's just a hood and a completely irresponsible guy named Bruno, the last person in the world you'd ever want to hand a child to. But unfortunately, that's what his girlfriend Sonia does. And at one point in the film, fairly early, he's with the baby. Sonia's away. I can't remember exactly where. He does exactly what any upstanding father would do. He sells the baby on the black market to get some cash, thinking that somehow, like everything in his life, he can make this work. That doesn't seem like that bad of a decision. Sonia will understand. He'll roll with it. Sonia doesn't understand. Sonia takes it very, very hard, as you may imagine. And that reaction really does force him to then reconsider. And even though you're not going to get any moments out of L'Enfant like you get in some of these other films where characters have these epiphanies that they clearly go, I have to change myself. I don't know that Bruno ever has that kind of clarity, but almost against his will, he is forced to kind of have a new start. He's forced to try to rectify the situation, finally take responsibility for his actions, and set things straight as best he can. But at that point, maybe things have gone so far, there's no going back. That all the want in the world, all the positive feelings in the world can't make that happen after something as shocking, after an act that deplorable. And, you know, The Kid with a Bike is a movie we talked about here on the show. The Sun has come up. Lorna's Silence is a movie I think I brought up before as well. Whenever I talk about the Dardans, I think about the crucibles they put their characters through. Their characters have to go through these tough tests. They have moments where they can make the right decision or they can make the wrong decision. And because these are dramas and often tragic ones, they make the bad one, of course. Very spare plots from the Dardans, but they're so able to evoke tension out of these crucibles and provoke really heartbreaking and also frustrating, disturbing moments where these characters are forced to confront their standing within a larger context, see themselves within society, see themselves within humanity. And David Edelstein from New York Magazine, writing about it, he said, of course, when you introduce a helpless infant into a movie, the stakes immediately rocket. So there you go. I'm not making up stakes. Even Edelstein used it. He says their handheld camera catches tiny flickers of emotion that few filmmakers come near. You feel as if you're watching the movements of a soul. And he says every act in the film has a mythic resonance. And that really is the line that I think sums up so much of the Dardenne's work. There is the spareness to it, the simplicity of it, that every action has consequences and stands out. And you feel almost like they have mythic proportions to it. So L'Enfant is my number one.
Not nearly as good of a film, but one that's connected to that, actually, that was an honorable mention for me, is John Singleton's Baby Boy. I thought about
that. I like that film, too.
Similar story, completely different setting. But I also had Groundhog Day, as I said, as an honorable mention. And then two that I've had on top five lists. One would have been very literal interpretation in terms of rebirth. That's Children of Men.
Yeah.
I had it as top five movie dystopias, though.
Yeah.
And then Alice doesn't live here anymore, I would have loved to include it, but just gave that some attention with top five mother-son relationships last year.
And Alice was a film that I believe also made my top five or 10 movies about starting over. So it was in the mix there. For me, I will mention just a few other films, because obviously I picked some movies, as I said, by design that had never come up before. There are tons of great films I also could have mentioned here during this segment, but one that has definitely gotten love on the show throughout the years, Sullivan's Travels, another movie, though, about a character trying something new with his life. Two movies that qualified and I almost put on my list because there are movies that have never gotten top five love. Working Girl, starring Melanie Griffith in the Mike Nichols film, and also Michael Clayton, another film that I feel like I didn't give enough credit to the first time around.
Boy, people have just forgotten that. I mean, when it came out, it was Best Picture nominee, right?
I think it was, or at least it was supposed to have been.
Maybe there was a lot of chatter about it.
I
don't hear anybody
it.
Talking about that
No,
anymore.
And then two movies that I do think qualify but have come up recently on the show in terms of discussions and end-of-year lists, The Master from P.T. Anderson and Jeff Who Lives at Home. The film I really do love from the Duplass brothers is absolutely a movie about starting over and turning over a new leaf. So those are just a few of the honorable mentions, and those are our top five turning over a new leaf movies. We look forward to your picks. You can send those to us or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail at our brand new number, 312-264-0744. Or find us on Twitter at Filmspotting and at Facebook.com/Filmspotting.
Out in limited release, opening here in Chicago, speaking of Hayao Miyazaki from Up on Poppy Hill, this is the directorial debut of Gorō Miyazaki, who is Hayao Miyazaki's son. It's about a group of Yokohama teens who want to save their school clubhouse from the wrecking ball in preparation for the 1964 Tokyo Olympics. Gimme the Loot is out. It's from director Adam Leon, about a crew of graffiti artists who set out to pull off kind of their ultimate mission to graffiti the New York Mets home run apple. Our buddy Scott Tobias from the AV Club is a fan of the movie, said it reminded him a little bit of Linklater. And there's a new Toni Collette film out as well, where she's reteaming with the director of Muriel's Wedding, Liev Schreiber, also in the movie called Mental. One I'm really curious about is Reality. This is the latest from Italian director Matteo Garrone, who gave us Gomorra a few years ago. It's a dramatic comedy about a fishmonger who becomes obsessed with being on a reality show.
We have a couple other limited releases to let you know about. The Sapphires is the story of the 60s Australian girl group. Four members of the Sapphires were Australian Aboriginals. Starbuck is coming out, too. This is a 2011 film from Canadian director Ken Scott. It's about a man who faces a class-action lawsuit filed on behalf of the 142 children he fathered as a result of artificial insemination. It's Tyler Perry time again. Apparently, we have Tyler Perry's Temptation. An ambitious married woman is tempted by a handsome billionaire. I hate it when that happens. And lastly, Wrong. This is from the director of the 2010 cult film Rubber. A guy wakes up one morning to realize he's lost the love of his life, his dog, Paul.
There you go. Out in wide release, G.I. Joe Retaliation, the director of Step Up to the Streets and Step Up 3D, teams up with Step Up's Channing Tatum to defeat Cobra with Dwayne Johnson and Bruce Willis.
That's a lot of stepping up.
Wow. The Host is out as well. No, not the Bong Joon-ho film from a few years ago. This is Saoirse Ronan in an adaptation of Stephanie Meyer's novel, Stephanie Meyer's of Twilight fame, about unseen enemies taking over human bodies. Andrew Niccol from Gattaca fame directs. I just saw this trailer today.
Please tell me it looked all right.
It looked better than the Twilight movies. I'll give you that. It definitely looked better than the Twilight movies, and it seemed like it would be made by Andrew Niccol, the guy who made Gattaca.
That I like.
And I love Saoirse Ronan, so who knows? It just might be worth seeing. Of all those movies we just mentioned, Josh, do you have one film that you're most interested in seeing for yourself?
Yeah, Tyler Perry's Temptation.
Of course. But really, your answer is what?
From Up on Poppy Hill.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do want to check that out.
For me, it's the film Reality. I know it hit the festival circuit. I want to say it played the Cannes Film Festival and got a lot of positive feelings there. So that's a movie, just based on what I've heard about it, and his follow-up to Gomorra, a film that was really fascinating. That's the one I'm most curious to check out. Next week, it's a Michael Phillips Friday edition of Film Spotting with our Sacred Cow review of The Evil Dead. We're also going to share our top five tracking shots.
That's going to be fun.
Which is a tie-in not only with The Evil Dead, but also the third film in our Max Ophuls marathon, The Earrings of Madame De. Should be a great show.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Hogren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to Tori Malatia and Shauna Coyne at WBEZ Chicago Public Media. Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect our community, our nation, and our world. For more information, go to chicagopublicmedia.org. Featured music this week was from Kid Dakota. You can learn more at facebook.com/Kid Dakota. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.